This is the Alembic Files. I'm Al, and Theo is on assignment. Theo's putting together a show that's going to be very interesting. A lot of the stuff, in fact, all the stuff that we do, unfortunately has to be this way, is little-known history. That's why we have, for instance, Eric in the series that he's doing right now. We'll talk to him today. Because it's a person that nobody really has ever heard of. A dissenting voice, and that's the reason why you haven't heard. So you may have freedom of expression in America, and try to use it and see what happens to you. And I will tell you, just as a teaser, that the individual's name is Lawrence Dennis, and you've never heard of him. So he's working on that. We're going to do a show imminently to deal with this individual, what he had to say, and why you don't know about him. And also we're going to have another series coming up parallel to what Eric's doing, and that's going to be entitled Poetic Perplexities, Emerging Visions of Global Empire. And that's going to deal with literature that was written back, I guess, as far as maybe the 18th century. Well, definitely the 18th century, maybe even a little bit before. But, again, some people knew what they could expect in time to come. And, again, you've heard of some of these people, but not many. So we have that series coming up. We'll have this show right after this one dealing with Lawrence Dennis. And we have back with Phantasms of Freedom. Say that fast. With Eric the Blacksmith, and we're going to go to, what is this now, round three, I believe, isn't it?
Yes, hi, Al. Thanks for having me back on.
We had round no choice. You're not done your contract yet.
That's right.
this runs parallel to what you're doing, as with the anti-federalist voices, and again, you're dealing with something with a dissenting opinion, which is supposed to be allowed to have, and I guess that means you can just say it, but no one's going to listen, and like everybody's going to like throw dirt on it, so nobody ever hears about this again, and that's what you're doing as well. So I don't know if you want to do anything summarily about what happened in the last two episodes, but no matter how that gets you up and running into this third one, by all means, take it away.
Okay, I wanted to mention the Holy See of Antioch that I talked about last time, which was what the informer said he received the letter from, or who the informer said he received the letter from, was the Holy See of Antioch.
Uh-huh.
And I suppose it should just be called the Holy See. But I think if I remember right, the Holy See of Antioch, that's pretty much where it all started, the first pope. And I guess it was, I'm thinking it was in Syria, Middle East, somewhere in the Middle East. But, yeah, it should really be referred to as the Holy See. I just referred to it as the Holy See of Antioch because that's, you know, I was just parroting what the informer said. And I got curious and I decided to look into it a little bit more. And there's a few Holy Sees around that I didn't even know about.
And neither do I, to be honest with you. So, yeah, okay, I get it. But when you hear the Holy See, usually that's where I stop, no matter what they want to attach to it later, because it has to do with the Pope. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And I wanted to talk about a little bit more about why I pursue this, or on why I pursue this whole thing. I'm not a communist, a Marxist, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm just another bozo on the bus who wants to know what's really going down. And after finding out what I've learned, I gotta say that I'm kind of relieved to know that that gnawing feeling that something wasn't right has been borne out. And it's like I said last time, everything I've checked out so far has been on the mark. And it's the little nooks and crannies of history that I didn't realize, I didn't know about. And it's kind of like, I don't know, it's a geometric progression. As I've studied and learned stuff, you know, every answer leads to two more questions, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I understand. I mean, that was my experience also, just somewhat before, I guess, a lot of the people with whom I relate today. But they were all looking also for some answers. And I don't know if it has anything to do with a certain demographic. It does seem to a certain extent, but I can't say that it's 50 or 60% of people that are probably 50 or older, because a lot of us grew up just, I mean, like I've said before, I mean, hearing things and they're not jiving with what we were taught in our history texts, you know, whether it's soldiers coming back from World War II and the stuff I overheard and then just plain things that, I mean, that just are done and they don't make sense. And when you ask questions, you don't get good answers. I mean, it could be something as banal as, why the heck is there an electoral college? You know, it's like, you know, why are there lobbyists? You know, isn't that bribery in any other business? And it's like, well, you know, that's because, no, why? Tell me why. But that's what we do. you know, we just...
I recall you talking about when you were younger, hearing relatives or those in your circle talking about things that just didn't jive. And I guess, I mean, could it be accurately said that some seeds were planted in your mind about those things?
Apparently, because even though you go on with your life, and you just don't forget them. And then what will happen is something also pop up along the way, you know, maybe 7-8 years later, and then that kicks back to what you heard, you know, and I'm referring to, you know, it could be, and it usually was, you know, Dad takes me to the softball game, you know, in the 1950s, and then he has to take me to the bar where the guys all drink afterward, and there's a lot of veterans in there, and of course they get a little bit pried loose, you know, their tongues pried loose with alcohol, and you start to hear stuff that it wasn't necessarily BS. I mean, because you could see that they were just still torn up about it. Now, I mean, here I am like 7 years old, and I remember that. You know, I don't know why. I don't know if I was any more sentient than somebody else was at that age, but I remember that. I mean, I stood there and I took note of it, and I can still see it to this day. I can smell it to this day. And then I go on, and something else happens, you know, and after a while you turn around and say, what is going on? You know, and here we are today. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's the old story about everything you feared is true.
Yeah. I wanted to mention more from the book, The Hologram of Liberty,
right,
by Kenneth Royce, which has been a phenomenal book. The more I refer to the bibliography that he lays out, the more impressed I am. And I wanted to read a section here from No Treason. This is the 1973 reprint of No Treason. And James J. Martin wrote, since late Neolithic times, men in their political capacity have lived almost exclusively by myths. And these political myths have continued to evolve, proliferate, and grow more complex and intricate with a steady replacement of one by another over the centuries. These myths attempt to examine the origins of the state with little or no attention to its historic record, and then try to justify and fortify it in the face of criticism or objection. Vasily Klyuchevsky, the giant of historical scholarship in the last century of Tsarist Russia, put it best, quote, the state swells up, the people diminish, unquote. Part of the reason for this in America has been the much more opaque and intangible nature of the adversary. The tying of political tenure to astronomy, that is, of regular elections, instead of dynasty, has removed the possibility of a long-enduring personal symbol of monarchy from the scene. And a massive obstacle has been created as a result of the homogenization growing out of mass voting, mass taxpaying, mass gun-bearing, and mass dispersal of the tidbits bestowed by the state. A vast, gray, shapeless enterprise of bureaucracy has come into being, with which it has been difficult to come to grips, as in the manner of classical conflicts with the state. Here's where it gets good. The American genius has been concentrated in perfecting vague and generalized secular verbiage, elusive, imprecise terminology which often sets the line for seemingly interminable battlegrounds of conflicting interpretation. Expressions such as general welfare, public good, social contract, general will, and many others come to mind. Of course, the crowning achievement in the American experience was the production of the Constitution, the ultimate verbal bastion on which is perched the American state. Constitution worship is our most extended public political ritual, frequently supervised as often by mountebanks as by the sincere. For though we have had over a century of native critics and opponents of our state, the Constitution has largely been exempted or neglected in the unfolding of this critical tradition. Consequently, in view of the evanescent nature of power tenure in this country, the frequent unhorsing of the holders and exercisers of state power is looked upon with equanimity and not considered a threat in any way to the state. It is the assault upon the abstract and verbal underpinnings of this institution, the rules of the game, remember,
uh-huh,
which draws blood, so to speak. If one can consider all the participants in the struggle to control and use the states as those, I'm sorry, and use the state as those engaged in a game, then those who seek to destroy the abstract verbal justification for such play are endangering the future course of all the players by riddling the rule books, which describes how such play is to be conducted while giving it a raison d'etre besides. Those who attack the rationale of the game and not the players are its most formidable adversaries. It is in light of this that those who have the temerity to collide head-on with the Constitution and challenge its validity in toto stand out in such sharp outline and radiate a quality of uniqueness in the American anti-state library. That is from No Treason by James J. Martin. I know that's a long read, that's a mouthful, but I thought it really encapsulated what I've been trying to do with the studies of the anti-federalists, that basically we're dealing with parchment worship. We're dealing with, I don't know, a fantasy.
Something has, every culture, every country has to have something to hang on to, I guess. And it doesn't matter if it was real or not. And it seems that the more time passes in between that whatever event that really was and whether it was reported accurately, it doesn't matter because in the decades that take, you know, that go on, it takes on another whole thing and it becomes something to be worshipped, but it never existed. I mean, that's why, you know, I have to laugh when I hear people say, you know, we have to get our Constitution back. Well, you never had it to begin with. And when was the last time you used it? You know, they feel that these protections are just an umbrella over them and all these injustices ping off it. But it's like you've never really been in the crosshairs of a bad situation, because if you were, you'd find out just how useless the Constitution is. And I mean, you know, time and time again, we've heard stories about people going head to head with the federal government. And that's really where it becomes very, very apparent that you have no constitutional rights. You have no rights.
I have to include something here that's a little more present day, but it happened recently. Of course, after the Sandy Hook massacre, the Connecticut State Legislature passed some laws, actually more like railroaded some laws through, and some of the local gun groups have recently filed suit against the state of Connecticut, and they're doing it on constitutional grounds. And I've talked to some of my shooting buddies, and I've told them that if that's the way they're going about this, they're going to lose. In Connecticut, there's a procedure for enacting legislation that involves public hearings and certain procedures. They have to convene groups to explore the ramifications of legislation. You know, okay, we're going to pass this law. How's it going to affect Joe Blow and Sally Soccer Mom? They didn't do any of that. The governor of Connecticut was so desperate to get this law passed, and, of course, the Dems in the House, which are a vast majority in this state, just ramrodded this through. If they didn't go and sue the state on the grounds of violating the what's called the e-certification and just went with the constitutional parameter, I think they're going to get their rear ends handed to them. I need to look into this more and find out what the details are. But any time somebody takes the Constitution to federal court or district court, they lose. And I don't think this is going to be any exception. That's where I'm going with it.
Well, watch it. I mean, I've been remiss in doing an audio dedicated to the instances where federal judges have told the defendant who wants to use the Constitution as a remedy, as a protection, to go pound it. Now, the Patriot Idiots, for as long as I had been listening, were banging on the judges for doing that. Now, the judges, one, are private, if you will, okay? They're a whole brotherhood unto themselves. And here's another, I mean, this is part of the audio I have not yet done. You cannot go after them for anything. They are impervious to any kind of liability because they are, in a sense, judges that belong to a private corporation. So they are, yeah, culpable on that level, but they are only doing what they are charged, quote, legally to do. And that doesn't come from them. It comes from what they serve, and that is the corporation known as the United States. So if you go in as a private citizen, and I'll detail some of these cases yet to come. I mean, they've already happened, but I mean, I've yet to lay them out. You'll see you've got no shot whatsoever. If you go in there and use the Constitution, you're told take a hike because you are not, well, you know, I'm preaching to the choir here, but people don't understand. You are considered a private citizen, it is not a party to the contract known as the Constitution. Only the states are. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eric.
That's okay. It's interesting. I want to stress to folks out there, don't take our words for this. You know, don't just believe what we say wholesale. Do some research and check it out, and you'll be surprised at the very least at what you find. And I also mentioned in the emails that we've swapped back and forth about something I called, or at least questioned, America's first false flag. This was the Gaspee fire of 1772. I recalled that you and Theo did an interesting show about false flags. And I was curious about the Gaspee affair, and there's certainly a lot I have to learn about this. I sent the link to you, which you did include for the last show we did.
Right.
And I'll just read a little bit from this. It's often been surmised by historians that the attack on HMS Gaspee was occasioned by the combination of Rhode Island colonists angry at the British revenue schooner interrupting free trade in Narragansett Bay, and the fortuitous grounding of the king's vessel giving opportunity for its destruction. But was this really a coincidence? What is presented here is an examination of the evidence that the destruction of the Gaspee had actually been deliberately planned well ahead of time. The HMS Gaspee was the local representative of a class of relatively small and fast revenue schooners that the Royal Navy purchased from various American shipbuilders to enforce maritime law and trade regulations along the East Coast. She took up station in Newport sometime in February 1772 and lost no time in making her presence known by stopping, searching, and seizing ships that were suspected of carrying illicit or untaxed cargoes. Lieutenant William Dudingston, I think D-U-D-I-N-G-S-T-O-N, I'm going to say that's Dudingston,
yeah,
and
okay.
His crew were considered particularly heavy-handed in performing their duties, plundering Rhode Island ships and cargoes, and stealing cattle and supplies from coastal communities up and down Narragansett Bay. As related in Judge William Staples' documentary history of the destruction of the Gaspee, and they have a URL here, I do have some more stuff to send you, some links, and
sure.
An article from the New York Times, actually, from 1913, I think, or was it 1922, either or. But it was an article about the Gaspee in the New York Times.
Okay.
The revenue schooner captured a packet sloop of rum and proceeded to beat up the vessel's hapless captain, Rufus Green. These representatives from the Royal Navy had no respect for the colonists, and the captured vessel Fortune and her cargo were sent up to Boston as a customs prize. Since Rhode Island law required local adjudication of such matters, the local citizenry was incensed, a lawsuit was initiated by the Greens for illegal seizure, and a warrant was issued for Duddingston's arrest. And it goes on, it talks more about this. And to discuss this in more detail, consider that the American colonists considered themselves as having the same rights as all Englishmen had throughout the realm of the British Empire. Among such rights, generally given by the Magna Carta, well, we know the story behind that, were the rights to a trial by a jury of peers and the right to a local trial. The British Commission of Inquiry on the Gaspee Affair bypassed local courts. Its authority granted it by King George III of sending suspects out of the local area directly to England for trial would make defense impossible. Local colonial courts, long accustomed to judicial independence, tended to side with the defendant in any action against the Crown. British courts would not. And it goes on. Basically, this ship was burned, and it's believed that the Sons of Liberty were involved, and there was a mole in the Sons of Liberty, a guy named Church. I don't really know much more than that. But what happened, the upshot was that the Crown, England, said, okay, you guys, are going to be tried under our auspices and not your auspices.
Oh, what did that mean exactly, under whose law?
Well, it basically went directly to the king as opposed to any kind of representatives that they had over here.
For it to be a complete false flag operation. Okay, in this situation then, like, all right, because there's a few that are different. I mean, there's some that the government actually promotes, instigates, you know, and then steps back, like the Murrah building bombing and, well, you know, from the way things look, it could even be like the Boston bombing, you know, that. And there's also things like Fort Sumter. This would be kind of akin to Fort Sumter, where I'm assuming that if the bad guys do A, they know that the good guys will do B, and you want them to do that so you can clamp down even harder on them. Would that be someone? I know that's abstract, but is that the kind of case here?
Yes, and I have a little bit more here. It says the leadership of the American colonies, long incensed over unfair taxation without representation issues, immediately recognized this action by the British and Rhode Island as a serious threat to the rights and liberties they had considered unalienable. Immediate action was necessary, and the committees of correspondence were but the first of these actions. This single act of the burning of the Gaspee led directly to the unification movement of all the colonies, which, when united, became the United States of America. I don't know how organic this was, or if it was somebody just taking advantage, say, King George III or the Crown, taking advantage of this, and the butterfly effect?
No, tell me about it.
The butterfly effect? I guess it's, okay, the butterfly.
Does it have to do with caterpillars?
Its wings, and the cat gets startled, which makes the dog run out into the road.
Okay.
The car hits the dog, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Next thing you know, the country's on fire.
Well,
I just asked the question about the false flag because of the mole factor in the Sons of Liberty, and the Sons of Liberty were involved, if I remember, in this attack on the Gaspee. It's just kind of a question I have, and I just wanted to bring it up and discuss it with you to see what you might have thought about it, or if you had known anything about this incident, or if Theo does.
It would seem to me that what you had mentioned and the aftermath is, I mean, whatever is the result is you can tell the reason why it happened. So in other words, I mean, as far as I can see from looking at it cursorily, and that is, I assume the colonists were supposed to be due the same rights as British subjects in the UK.
Uh-huh.
And in this case, it just seems that things are a little bit harsher because apparently this sent a wave through, I don't know how many state legislations, whatever they were called at the time, coming down with more draconian laws. To me, that's what stands out. And that is now all of a sudden they've been battening down the hatches on situations that were somewhat addressed but not treated with, I guess, the same severity as they were after the fact. It's as if now after the Gaspee, this is the way things are going to be.
Yeah, we can, as it goes on, we can ascertain from letters kept at the Rhode Island Historical Society, there were local branches of the Sons of Liberty in Providence, Newport, and Portsmouth. Unfortunately, the letters to and from branches of the Sons of Liberty were addressed only as the Sons of Liberty in Providence, with no specific person's name attached. But apparently the local postmaster knew who to deliver the mail to. Lovejoy cites that wealthy and influential Providence merchant John Brown, who led the attack on the Gaspee, was a member of the Sons of Liberty. Prominent Sons of Liberty member Silas Downer is known to have given a famous speech to the Providence chapter of the Sons of Liberty at the dedication of their Liberty Tree in 1768. So there's the website that I linked is just huge. There's so much to this. But I guess when I hear false flags, I'm thinking to myself, well, geez, you know, these have happened ever since the dawn of man.
Yeah.
And could it have been a factor in the burning of the Gaspee?
Well, then take a look later on, because some believe that this set a pattern that it would eventually lead to a showdown, Lexington and Concord. That, you know, you're pushing us, and they knew they were pushing us. And then that would mean that, in a sense, the Brits wanted some kind of battle, some kind of military event. And for what purpose, if, in fact, they did not, If we didn't win it, I mean, now this gets really, I mean, far afield. But, I mean, where we're going with this is the whole thing was orchestrated by the Brits to bring us to where we are today and what we've been living under. We didn't win the revolution. You know, the Brits didn't necessarily do so well on the battlefield, but then how hard were they trying? You know, they had their hands full with other European continental intrigues. And it seems that they wanted to push this to a certain place to get a certain result. And that is, for the most part, Eric, can we not agree that what they wanted more than anything else was that their return on their investment in the creation of the colony should not be disrupted?
Which brings me to this, Al.
And I didn't even know
this. Segue.
Isn't that great?
This is what's that?
Sometimes you just get lucky.
This is a great segue. I have a book that's referred to, and I was telling you and Theo about this book. I've kept it. I've been sitting on it. And this is a book that's referred to in Hologram of Liberty. And if I can find the excerpt that talks about this.
The book is probably underneath you.
Well, I have the book in my hand, but I'm trying to find the reference. Anyway, the book, I'll just get to it. The book is called An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States by Charles A. Beard. Now, he initially published this book in 1913. It was republished in 1939 with a new introduction. I have the PDF of this book that I will send to you and Theo if you'd like.
Ooh, wait, copyright laws, make sure no one's listening.
Well, it was, let's see.
Is it public domain?
I believe so, because it was originally 1939.
Just say
yes. I'm sorry, 1913 that it was published. But at the very least, I can provide a link. So.
And then you can send me the PDF anyway. We'll let them hear that.
Okay, here it is. Yes, I found it. The Federalist Papers and post-ratification propaganda have successfully placed the Constitution beyond the range of critical inquiry. It is America's number one sacred cow. Within our civic religion, we may haggle over the drapery of political personalities, but it is utterly heretical to question the constitutional edifice itself. When Beard's 1913 An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution was published, the Ohio Star headlined, quote, "Scavengers, hyena-like, desecrate the graves of the dead patriots we revere," unquote. President Taft denounced the book before over 1,000 prominent lawyers and politicians at the Waldorf Astoria. Beard, hounded out of his Columbia professorship by 1917, had might as well gone to Mecca and called Muhammad the devil. Now, I'm through the first half of this book, and he lays out some fascinating theories, and he talks about every one of these delegates to the Constitutional Convention. And the vast majority of these people, Al, were landed gentry, fabulously wealthy.
Right.
They were very deeply involved with speculation and security. And in fact, he talks about a number of these members studying in the inner temple, the inns of court, and the middle temple.
Yeah.
And what he basically says is that a strong central government would allow the delegates to recoup any potential financial losses or risks that they had engendered.
So it was in, all right, if I understand this correctly, aligning it with what we've heard and what we've read with regard to our founders, and that is it would behoove them to have a central government because they, as businessmen, now you mentioned that they were involved in land speculation, and that's true, real estate. They were slavers, they were bankers and lawyers, and a lot of them, I won't say a lot of them because I can't cite numbers, but there is a decent percentage of them who also had still some business interests in England. So they were threatened with the end of those enterprises if something wasn't done to make sure that England got its due tribute.
And exactly.
And the best way to do that was to take the several states and federate them under a central government, which the colonists didn't want.
No, they certainly didn't. And here's something about George Washington. And this is a quote from Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. Washington of Virginia was probably the richest man in the United States in his time, and his financial ability was not surpassed among his countrymen anywhere. He possessed, in addition to his great estate on the Potomac, a large amount of fluid capital which he judiciously invested in western lands, from which he could reasonably expect a large appreciation with the establishment of stable government and the advance of the frontier. Perhaps the best way to illustrate his economic interest is to give the data from the schedule of his property attached to his will drawn up in 1799. He possessed in Virginia, counting the enormous holdings on the Ohio and the Great Kanawha, more than 35,000 acres valued at $200,000. Now, this, of course, is in the late 18th century. We're talking king's ransoms here. In Maryland, that was my little carrot there that I threw in. In Maryland, 1,119 acres at $9,828. In Pennsylvania, 234 acres at $1,404. In New York, about 1,000 acres at $6,000. In the Northwest Territory, 3,051 acres at $15,255. In Kentucky, 5,000 acres at $10,000. Property in Washington at $19,132. In Alexandria at $4,000. In Winchester at $400. At Bath, $800. He held $6,246 worth of United States securities, and of this holding he said, quote, "These are the sums which are actually funded, and though no more in the aggregate than $7,566, stand me in at least 10,000 pounds Virginia money, being the amount of bonded and other debts due me and discharged during the war when money had depreciated in that rate, and was so settled by the public authority," unquote. He held $10,666 worth of shares in the Potomac Company presented to him by the state of Virginia, which he left to establish a national university, $500 worth of James River Company shares, $6,800 worth of stock in the Bank of Columbia, and $1,000 worth of stock in the Bank of Alexandria. His own slaves were to be emancipated on the death of his wife. His livestock he estimated at $15,653, making a grand total at a conservative estimate of $530,000. This guy was fabulously wealthy.
Can you confirm anything in what you've come across? I've not seen it with my own eyes. I got some information to the effect several years ago and didn't think much about it, where either he or I believe his wife, we're talking about Martha, right?
Yes.
Was involved was a shareholder in the Bank of England. All right, we can't confirm that from what you've come across, right?
So far, I have not been able to confirm that, but I will do some digging on that.
But here's the point as well, though, and that is, do we really believe what we were told, that Hamilton and his faction could overpower Washington and ram through the first central bank? Really?
I've come to realize or believe that Washington was really very influenced by Hamilton. And Hamilton made a number of trips. In fact, in Hologram of Liberty, Mr. Royce lays out his itinerary, Hamilton's itinerary. And it's fascinating how many trips he made back and forth to Philadelphia in dealing with the banksters. It's a fascinating study as to just how much of a trickster this guy was.
Okay.
None of the records of his dealings, as far as I can tell, are available. So in it talks here about rewarding speculators and stiffing veterans. And this is from his works. "The public creditors, who consisted of various description of men, a large proportion of them very meritorious and very influential, had a considerable agency in promoting the adoption of the new Constitution, for it exhibited the prospect of a government able to do justice to their claims." Hamilton's first Caper, in the name of instituting sound public credit, was to ensure that speculators in Revolutionary War securities were cashed out at full face value, though they had built the original holders, mostly veterans, of these bonds for pennies on the dollar. And they have there's an article here, or a missive that Jefferson wrote, and he's just banging on Hamilton in this. Having just returned from France in 1789, Hamilton's financial system had then passed. It had two objects. First, as a puzzle to exclude popular understanding and inquiry. Second, as a machine for the corruption of the legislature, for he avowed the opinion that man could be governed by one of two motives only, force or interest. Force, he observed, in this country was, at the time, out of the question, and the interests, therefore, of the members must be laid hold of, to keep the legislature in unison with the executive. And with grief and shame, it must be acknowledged that his machine was not without effect, that even in this, the birth of our government, some members were found sordid enough to bend their duty to their interest and to look after personal rather than public good. It is well known that during the war, the greatest difficulty we encountered was the want of money or means to pay our soldiers who fought, or our farmers, manufacturers, and merchants who furnished necessary supplies of food and clothing for them. After the expedient of paper money had exhausted itself, certificates of debt were given to the individual creditors with assurance of payment so soon as the United States should be able. But the distress of these people often obliged them to part with these for the half, the fifth, and even a tenth of their value, and speculators had made a trade of cozening them from the holders by the most fraudulent practices and persuasions that they would never be paid. In the bill for funding and paying these, Hamilton made no difference between the original holders and the fraudulent purchasers of this paper. Great and just repugnance arose at putting these two classes of creditors on the same footing, and great exertions were used to pay the former the full value, and to the latter the price only which they had paid with interest. But this would have prevented the game which was to be played, and for which the minds of greedy members were already tutored and prepared. When the trial of strength on these several efforts had indicated the form in which the bill would finally pass, this being known within doors sooner than without, and especially then to those who were in distant parts of the Union, the base scramble began, couriers and relay horses by land and swift-sailing pilot boats by sea were flying in all directions. Active partners and agents were associated employed in every state, town, and country neighborhood, and this paper was bought up at 5 shillings and even as low as 2 shillings in the pound. Before the holder knew that Congress had already provided for its redemption at par, immense sums were thus filched from the poor and ignorant, and fortunes accumulated by those who had themselves been poor enough before. Men thus enriched by the dexterity of a leader would follow, of course, the chief, that is Hamilton, who was leading them to fortune and became the zealous instruments of all his enterprises. This is from Thomas Jefferson's recollection of the Hamiltonian system, 4th of February, 1818. Yeah, that was from 1818, and Jefferson may have been a ne'er-do-well and deserving of denigration. But in that statement, I think he really encapsulated what Hamilton did to bilk so many people out of a lot of money. He had Hamilton nailed dead to rights on his trickery and on a lot of his personal dealings.
He sent his VP to kill him.
You know. I do recall what the informer said about the enmity between Burr and Hamilton, that Burr would chide Hamilton about being a black Jew. I recall the informer saying that. I have not read anything about that in any account. Now, of course, Hamilton, yes, he did have some black heritage, and there was no love lost between Burr and Hamilton at all.
Well, no, they were both, I would think, egomaniacs.
Yes.
Hamilton was born in the islands.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so whether he had, you know, whether he was a mulatto or whatever, you know, who cares? But if that were at the core. But the thing that got me about Jefferson is this. He is such a hypocrite. My God. I mean, you know, D.C. and books and are just filled with his platitudinous statements. And he was just as much of a bigot penis as everyone else was down there. You know, I mean, he talks like he fakes God talk, you know, like he's another one of the Christians, which he wasn't. I mean, anybody's going to write his own Bible. I mean, you know, right now, Tommy's in the dirt room, okay?
There's pretty solid evidence that he was either in the OTO or one of the, the basic food groups of the Illuminati hierarchy.
Yeah, there's a story about him receiving something from the Illuminati in some website. It was very interesting. I don't know what he got necessarily. I forget now. It might have been the plates for the making of the dollar bills, okay? I don't know. But it would seem that he was hooked in. I mean, the guy wasn't a Christian. I mean, forget that. And that's okay if he wasn't, but just don't say you are and not be one. And it goes for the rest of the founders. Most of them were all phonies anyway. You know, anything, and we see it to this day. You know, just do something in the name of God, and it's okay. You know, oh, let's kill a couple of thousand Native Americans. It's all right.
Oh, and the book that I referred to, An Economic Interpretation by Charles Beard, he himself is an interesting character. And I can send you, I'll send you if you'd like a link on his biography, which he really had some interesting theories about history and geopolitics. And he gives a lot of information about each one of these delegates. And it was basically a who's who of the rich and the powerful. The little people. In reading this book, I realized more than ever, Al, the little people had nothing to do with the adoption,
no.
creation, and formation of this corporation known as the United States.
No, they all knew they got screwed. And that is another thing that has been quelled, is the dissent that there was amongst the several states. Now, look, we go through this time and time again with people who want to say, well, you know, they couldn't live under the Articles of Confederation. Well, okay, I get that. They couldn't, you know, go ahead and exist as separate states trying to do transactions and business with other countries. What happens if the other country came over and invaded New Hampshire? What would Virginia do? I mean, I get all that. But the bottom line was this. They all believed that the former colonists, now new state citizens, all believed that they were going to be under no federal umbrella. And that's exactly what happened. And they didn't want it. And they didn't want a central bank. And they got it. I mean, everything that, well, for however many fought for this among all those that became, obviously, new state citizens, they got exactly what they didn't want. That whole dissent, and this goes to the back, you know, to the beginning of the show. What we deal with is not, I mean, we don't do things because it's esoteric. We don't do things because they're little known. It just happens to be that there is a whole reality in history that has been suppressed. And here we are. And one of the things is that these people felt that they definitely got ambushed, double-crossed, and kicked to the curb, and they are right on all three counts. You know?
Yes, the thing that could have been tweaked about the articles would have been, say, the commercial dealings from state to state, the interstate commercial dealings, taxes, tariffs, what was known as the New Jersey Compromise. Would have brought the Constitution and the operation of this country very much in line with what the Swiss have today, and it's worked for them like a charm.
There's a joke there somewhere.
The Constitution gave the... I'm sorry?
There's a joke there somewhere.
I'll probably have a bad joke.
Okay.
Drum roll. Anyway, the Swiss have the systems with their cantons, and it seems to work quite well. But a lot of smoke and mirrors were written about the articles about how bad they were, and they weren't really that bad. Yes, they needed to be tweaked, but I think they would have worked, and maybe they were working a little too well.
Exactly, because the thing is, if you know, without going through the whole nine yards, because we've done this in other things, and then, you know, this is not the place to rehash it all. But if you are to believe that the reason why the Constitution was drafted was because it favored those that were in business. It also favored the consolidation of the states so that revenue could be generated, taken through a federal government, and then, you know, with taxation or whatever it was going to be, and then, which we're now told, is then it's funneled over to Europe. And that's why the Tea Party, you know, those idiots, you know, oh, the Federal Reserve's private. Oh, that's it. You know, that's not the end of the answer. I mean, that's not the end of the game, folks.
No, that's just the door opening.
Right. And you don't mess with the Fed because it is a global thing.
Yes, it is. And I think one of the problems with these patriots is that they're saying, well, let's get back to the Constitution. That's like saying, all right, I have a headache. I'll hit my head with a hammer so the headache goes away. They're dealing with the symptoms and not the cause.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eric.
No, it's okay. No, go ahead.
No, I mean, the thing is, it becomes a parroted line. And you get all these dweebs who just know to say that. And if you were to stop and say, will you explain that to me? They'd be hoppity, hoppity, hoppity. They don't need Jackie Gleason. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, now we can't concentrate for the rest of the 20 minutes, but that's all right.
Yeah, that's true. But, well, I wanted to talk about that other thing that the patriots and the fans of the Constitution like to talk about, and that's that little thing called the Bill of Rights. In Hologram, Mr. Royce talks very well to the Bill of Rights, and he says, however, let us understand that these amendments were a scrappy bone very grudgingly thrown to the people. Madison, this is from Henry Mayer's Son of Thunder, page 455, quote, Madison ignored all the recommendations that addressed the powers of government. Nothing on taxation as a last resort, a provision that appeared on every list, nothing on two-thirds vote from both houses for treaties, trade laws, or standing armies in peacetime, nothing toward the prohibition of monopolies urged by every state except Virginia. There was nothing that looked like the Grand Charter of Rights Mason and Henry had envisioned as a preface to the Constitution. Not only that, but the amendments which were offered had been written in alarmingly equivocal language. And he goes through the first ten amendments. The First Amendment forbids only prohibiting the free exercise of religion, not infringement, as the polygamous Mormons he has in parentheses. It also seems to invite the interpretation of protected speech being that solely of political content. And this one here about the second is certainly something I've run into. The Second Amendment, protecting the right to keep and bear arms, was couched within an unnecessary subordinate clause, which has caused confusion to this day. The third allows the quartering of soldiers in private houses without the owner's consent, if prescribed by law. During some future martial law, we may indeed see this occur. Well, look what happened in Boston recently, as a little mention I throw in there. Why do you think the modern census questionnaires demand such detailed information about your dwelling? Searches and seizures are prohibited in the fourth if they are not unreasonable, whatever that is, and the courts have thus far carved out at least 14 exceptions to the warrant requirement. The House recently passed, now this book was written around 1999, 1998. I don't know if there's been another edition since. The House recently passed H.R. 666, the Exclusionary Reform Act of 1995, which wholly circumvents the Fourth by allowing evidence seized without warrant if the cops believe that they operated within the Fourth Amendment. Wink, wink, this is Animal Farm-style jurisprudence. Due process of law is now a sick joke. In the Fifth, only capital or infamous crimes require grand jury indictments, and this is bypassed in the military or during, quote, time of war or public danger, whatever that is, unquote. The government may take private property for public use as long as the owner has been paid just compensation, calculated by the feds, of course. In the 1928 Springer ruling, Chief Justice Holmes opined, property must not be taken without compensation. He conveniently omitted just from just compensation. I'm sorry. Let me repeat that. Okay. Property must not be taken without compensation. He conveniently omitted just from just compensation. But some property may be taken or destroyed for public use without paying for it if you do not take too much. In the Sixth, courts have consistently ruled that, quote, all criminal prosecutions means only capital crimes as described in the Fifth. You have no right to a jury trial for crimes with sentences less than 6 months. Also, what constitutes a speedy trial should have been specified, and the right to non-licensed counsel should have been clearly guaranteed. In the Seventh, according to the rules of common law, allows federal courts reversible reviews of jury verdict. In the Eighth, the definition of excessive bail and fines and cruel and unusual punishment were purposely left to the whimsical interpretation of federal courts. The Ninth Amendment was well put, though robbed of its practical value by the Constitution as a whole. The Tenth Amendment was, in a vivid portent of things to come, emasculated by Madison's refusal to strictly limit the federal government to powers expressly delegated, even though expressly was promised to the states in Jay's circular letter. The feds can do anything they were merely delegated to do, which includes implicit and consequential powers. We were thrown a sop and told, there are your precious amendments, now shut up. So basically, what he's saying here, we don't have any real rights. My apologies for all that reading.
With this kind of situation, if you don't give enough information, people say you got nothing in lieu of them reading themselves. And so you have to give them something. I'm not making excuses for you, but that's the old situation that we go through all the time. If you're going to try to convert people, whatever that means, you got to have to give them some factual basis, which you've given us, and that's what we've done for all these years. It isn't sexy, but that's the way it is. And that you give sites also to where that information can be accessed, as we always have done, is enough. If people want to find it, they can find it. The question is, will they?
Right. Well, I mentioned my friend in the office who is really looking into this, and he's learned a lot of stuff, and he's reminding me of the journey I had when I was finding out all this stuff. And was I PO'd at first? Yes. But you know what? I'm really glad I've learned a lot of this stuff, and I can listen to a lot of the talking heads on the radio. And you know what? I was thinking about this whole thing with so-called conservative talk show hosts, you know, the Limbaughs, the Hannitys, the Levins, the Laura Ingrams. If they told the real skinny, they'd be off the air faster than crap through a goose.
The question is whether they know it or not. Some do, most don't. And, I mean, look, it took me, 50 years to finally realize it? And that's with looking and actually caring about it? I mean, I was in back of all this political ideology for how long? And then I finally said, you know what, this isn't working and something's not right here. But those folks...
Same here.
Yeah, but, you know, they're getting paid to do this. I mean...
Well,
I tell you what, let's hold the factual stuff right here if we can. And at least let's close with whatever remarks we want to exchange. I mean, I get worked up about it because it's the same old story. I mean, look, we're coming to, people will hear this after Memorial Day. You know, and that's always conflicted me because you got people who went off to fight believing that they were fighting for freedom and all this, and in essence, they weren't. That doesn't make them fools. It doesn't mean their lives were wasted. I mean, it's a very, very treacherous territory, and I understand it. But it's the same old thing time and time again. I mean, what were the real reasons we went off to war? And it's got to be good guys and bad guys, you know, and waving the bloody flag and all this. But in essence, people pretty much can get along, except that that's not what we're supposed to do. Now, the United States, and, you know, Liam, our correspondent in Northern Ireland, you know, likes to remind
Girl
me.
Girl Liam. I like Liam.
He's the best. But, he reminds me, he's like, look, you know, you guys got more freedom than most of the world does. And I said, Liam, I understand it. But we're coming to a point in our history where we're now starting to lose it. And I would say this, that we have been to a point where life has been good for most of us. All right. We always forget about the casualties, but let's not. But life has been good for most of us. But when you have much to lose, and the fall is that much greater. And we are going through it right now. And what drives me nuts is that most people don't understand what is happening to them. They don't pay that much attention. I can understand that. They like to say, well, my life is so busy. Well, you know, actually, you know what? It isn't. You fill it with a lot of crap, which is what we have the internet for nowadays, like a bunch of chimpanzees wasting all their time on Facebook and Twitter. But that's where we're into now. It might be terrorism. Well, what is terrorism? It's anything you want it to be. And that's what we've entered this last phase. Honestly, that's what it is. We've entered a last phase, and I have to laugh because people would pick up, and again, this isn't sexy reading, as we've been talking about, but it's full of meat, and that is Trotsky's little dissertation on, what was it, terrorism and communism?
I'm not sure.
All right, I forget. I mean, I read it and I gave it away. I mean, the idea of terrorism, where it turns that it's people against the state, is not a new idea. And just as you said, false flag operations are not new ideas. You go ahead, you cause a problem, you instigate a fight, you blame it on someone else, and then you come in with all these laws or whatever they are, and then you've got more control. It's, you know, here it is. Lastly, one of the things that I was exchanging emails with Theo about, I can only go, I mean, it's time to get away from 9/11. It's time for these organizations and whatever, they haven't done anything. Here's my point. If you guys stay in wondering exactly how they brought the towers down, exactly how the Boston bombing happened, and you stay there for years, what does it do? It keeps you in a hamster cage. It keeps you in that wheel. And you don't understand, and here's where I'm going with it. We're going to do an audio cult. It's about totalitarianism, stupid. And that's where we're going. That's what all this is about. All right. What we have is Sir Thomas More knows that they're Richie Rich or whatever, is a mole for Henry VIII. And everybody knows it. And he knows it. But he says, well, what would you want me to do? Do you want me to just, you know, go ahead and throw the guy into the Tower of London? And so Thomas says, Richard Rich, says, and go he should if he were the devil himself until he broke the law. And so Roper says, well, so now you give the devil the benefit of law? And Moore says, yes, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil? And Roper says, yes, I've cut down every law in England to do that. And then Moore finishes, oh, and when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper? The laws all being flat. This country is planted thick with laws from coast to coast. Man's law, not God's. And if you cut them down and you are just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the wind that would blow then? Yes, I'd give the devil the benefit of the law for my own safety's sake. And that's what's being forgotten. You know, to just go ahead and just say, well, we have whatever we have to do. Do we want to be free? Then take our freedoms away. Do we want to be indemnified against terrorism? Take our freedoms away. And this is where
there's such a powerful allegory in that story.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's so relevant. And 1,000 years from now, Al, that story will be relevant, and given things continuing the way they are.
And because it will be relevant, is a sad commentary on civilization. So anyway, thanks for being with us, Eric. Sorry we went a little far afield in there, but again, it all comes down to the situation we have and from where it stems, and that is the founding of this country and the myths that we've been told. Yes, we've had it good. Well, guess what? That's coming. That's leaving very quickly.